Welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. What really motivates people and why? It's a question of human behavior and economics. What is the best way to incentivize people to take action, even though the action would already probably benefit them? Well, we think we know the answer, but let's remove our assumptions. Let's work off the evidence. That's what Yuri Ganizzi and John A. List did. These two economists wrote the book, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So people just not going to do what the right thing automatically. You have to incentivize, you have to give them candy in order to move forward, Mr. List?
Yeah, that's one way to put it. You know, when you look at our motives to do something, many times they look very simple at the outset, but they end up being very complex. So in the book, The Y-Axis, we end up taking on very important questions about the whys of why we do things. For example, you know, why do people give to charitable causes? Why do men earn more money than women in labor markets? Why do people discriminate against one another? We take on these sorts of big picture questions by going out into the field and actually doing experiments on people without those people even realizing we're doing experiments on them.
So, Mr. Ganizzi, these are pretty elaborate experiments you guys get into.
Right. So if you want to tackle big questions, you need to do big experiments. And, you know, you started with the question, why do we need to give people candy to do stuff? And some of the problems that we are after are really big and hard to change. So think about people trying to lose weight or people trying to exercise more. It seems as if you have all the incentives over there and people are wasting huge amounts of money in order to achieve these goals, and yet they fail. And we try to see in these big experiments that you mentioned, we try to see if we can add some relatively small incentives to this, but put them in the right place and change the way people behave.
It seems that people are not very good at risk assessment and realizing that the present course that they're on, maybe down the line, is unsustainable. We see that a lot in our modern world, but there's not enough feedback telling them to change their ways. Is this part of the problem, Mr. List?
I think that's right. I think when you look at people who undersave or they don't get as much education as they should, I think that's exactly right. These are big and important decisions that people make, yet you very rarely receive feedback on those decisions, whether I should buy a house or whether I should get married. And you're exactly right. These are the things that we tend to miscalculate exactly what we should be doing, so many times we make the wrong choices.
And not making a choice is also a choice, right, Mr. Ganizzi?
Absolutely. So the main problem is that in some cases we can't really test it. You can't test marriage, you know. You can't have a controlled experiment whether you should get married or not. That's kind of hard, but on many other dimensions, like charities that we talk in the book or businesses, you introduce something new and you can get some data before you make the decision. So if you remember Netflix, for example, what they did with splitting the company, they did it without even trying to experiment and see what will the public reaction to this be, and they lost, you know, almost the entire company they lost because of this move. So even if you have big decisions, in many cases, in most cases, you can try and get some data about what's the right thing to do, and you should.
So is the lesson of the book, in a nutshell, that if you work off assumptions, you're playing with fire. Really, go to the data, test things at the bench. But when you do that with folks in these experiments, do these people know that they're part of an experiment, Mr. List?
I think you're exactly right. So many times we have these preconceptions or received wisdom, and, you know, anecdotes or wives' tales about exactly what's going to work and what's not going to work. And you ask me, you know, do people know that they're taking part in these experiments? Many times they don't. So we've been partnering with charities all around the country since 1998 to figure out why do people actually give to charitable causes and what keeps them committed to specific charitable causes. And in each one of those fundraising drives, we end up trying different incentive schemes, trying different tricks to find out exactly what works. And those donors indeed do not realize that they're taking part in an actual scientific experiment. Now, when you step back and ask, well, have I ever been part of one of these experiments? I'm going to ask your listeners a few questions. One, do they ever vote in presidential elections? You know, two, do they use the internet to search for retail purposes? If you've done either of those two things, it's likely that you have been one of our experimental participants.
By voting in a presidential election, I mean, are you manipulating the democratic process here?
Only subtly. So what we do is we contact people in the weeks prior to the elections, and we look for what informational content can we use to induce people not only to go out and vote, but also to see if we can induce people to vote for a particular side.
And so, yeah, are you, and how are you doing that? I'm sure there are people who'd pay a lot of money to find out how to induce people to vote for a particular candidate.
Well, I'm sure many of your listeners have received messages from the Democratic or Republican Party, and those messages contain different content. Those messages come via different media, and what our field experiments have shown is that some of those messages actually work quite effectively. So, for example, one way to get you out to the polls on that Tuesday in November is for me to contact you the weekend before the election and to tell you that next weekend I will come and ask you if you voted in the presidential elections. And that in and of itself, knowing that someone is going to come and talk to you about whether you plan to, whether you actually voted, induces a lot more people to go out and vote.
So, Mr. Ganese, do you go further than that and try and figure out why that is a trigger point for folks to see that this will make them go vote?
Right. So the stuff that we're trying to do over here was developed in the lab in which we saw that people have some cost of lying. So if you ask me, are you going to go to vote, I'll say yes, and that's fine. You know, I may actually mean that, but then, you know, when the day comes, I have better things to do. But if I know that you'll come back to ask me, then I'll have to answer one of two things. Either I'll tell you, oh, sorry, I didn't go, or I'll have to lie to you. And people really don't like lying. And we think that that's the mechanism behind it, because now people know that if they won't go to work, either they'll have to confess that they didn't go to vote, or they'll have to lie to you. And they don't like either option.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation with the authors of The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives, and The Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. You guys talked about how you've helped public radio stations with their pledge drives. We're in our pledge drive right now, so when we come back from the break, I'm going to pick your brains to figure out how we can do this better, if you will allow me to. And when we come back, we'll also take calls. If you've got questions for these geniuses of human behavior and economics, 1-800-614-8980, 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The book we're talking about, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives, and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. We've got the two authors on the line, Yuri Ganese and John A. List. They're economists, and they have discovered, and they have it in their book, that people are rational beings, but only when there are, sometimes they're not. So either you are or you're not, but you could be both at the same time. Is that pretty much it? Is that the answer, right, Mr. List?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that once we understand what really motivates people and what people really value, then they do act in a rational way. Now, what you can say is that sometimes people don't really value rational things, but as economists, we don't really tell people what they should value. You value what you want to value, and then after we figure out what you value, pretty much people behave in according to a rational model or in a rational way.
So when you know the rules, you can pretty much, people are predictable. Is that right, Uri?
It is, but, you know, trying to figure out what is it that motivates people, that's the real trick. That's the really interesting stuff. So that's our passion, right? Try and go and see what motivates you.
Okay, so you write in the book about NPR pledge drives, and you say, let me pull this up real quick, that, I got it here, that people, okay, what really makes people give to charity don't appeal to people's hearts, appeal to their vanity. And I have to object to that because our listeners are so wonderful and so smart and so good-looking, they would never fall for that. So John, how defend this, please.
Well, first, I have to agree with you, by the way.
So put it this way. I think the standard anecdote about why people give to a charitable cause is that they're altruistic. That's what we typically hear arguments based on, you know what? John just gave $500 to the United Way or to the Texas NPR. Isn't he an altruist? Now, what we find in our data is something much different than that. We find that many, many people give out of their own feelings of trying to make themselves feel better, an economist named Jim Andreoni coined a warm glow, that many people give based on trying to get this warm glow of giving. It doesn't really matter that the money goes to save a six-year-old girl who's homeless. That's all great, but what people are really moved by is making a donation to make themselves feel good. That's what we find in many, many data sets.
And that's impure altruism.
Exactly. You've hit on the exact correct terminology. Economists call that an impure altruism. Now, that's still important. It's important that we know that because, you know, as an economist, I don't really care why people give, but I want to know why they give so then I can talk to charities about leveraging that insight to actually raise more money for their cause.
And so you talk about the challenges that we have in our pledge drives, that we say we've got money on the table. Someone gave us money. If you pledge $100, we can double that today. Does that work? John.
Well, what you find is that indeed having a match does work, but our data suggests that the level of the match, and what I mean by level of the match is sometimes you hear radio stations like yours saying, send in $100 and we will match it with $100. At other times you say things like, send in $100 and we will match it with $200. So this is a higher match rate. What we find...
We don't have that kind of money, John.
Having a match indeed matters, but the match rate itself, whether it's 1-to-1, 2-to-1, or 3-to-1, that doesn't matter that much. It's just important to have a match in place.
So people, why does it matter to the person who makes the donation? They're still giving the same amount of money.
Yeah, see, I think what happens is when they hear that there's a match available, that sends a signal to them that an anonymous donor who must have some type of privileged information about the cause, that you've convinced that donor who has a lot of information about the cause to give his or her hard-earned money, and that sends a signal to them that this must be a high-quality good, so then they're more likely to give when there's that match dollar available.
So, Uri, why isn't it enough for people to just to say, I like the service, I like public radio, and if I realize if I don't, you know, pledge and support it, then it's going to go away? I mean, y'all talk about, you know, loss framing and gain framing, so that would be like loss framing, right?
Right. So let me give you an example. I live in San Diego, and we also have the pledge now, and I suffer a lot. Like I'm sure many of your listeners also suffer during this week, right? We want to go back.
No, they do never suffer. This is they love pledge drive. It's awesome.
Okay, so let me tell you about myself, right? So today is the last day of the pledge drive here, and I'm very happy. Or maybe it's tomorrow. But imagine that you'll say you need to collect $350,000 in donation. We're going to stop when we get there. So now, you know, the people that will give you money are still altruistic, but they also think, oh, God, if I'm not going to do this, it can last for another 2 weeks. I don't want that.
So give now.
Give now and we can go back to normal life.
Regular programming.
Exactly.
But I mean, but there's still the thing about why don't people just give? Why do we have to do all these tricks? I mean, people are rational, right? And if they could just...
Yeah, so I think the reason why people tend not to give is because they're rational. What they think is, look, my $50 or $100 is not going to make a difference, so I'm going to end up what economists call free ride on the contributions of others, because the program is going to be provided whether or not I send in my $100. So I'm going to free ride on everyone else's contributions and not give as much as I value the program. And that's the key, is that people are rational and they want a free ride, and they want everyone else to contribute because they realize that their little $50 or $100 really doesn't make that big of a difference.
And probably they've had, you know, they've had this experience where they haven't given, they've been tempted and they resisted temptation, they didn't pledge, and the radio station continued, and hey, see, I'm right, I don't have to give. But that can only work so long, you know?
Right, and that different kinds of people.
I think that's right. I think that it will work as long as there are enough other people who will step forward to give enough money to keep the high quality programming continuing.
So we got to convince people to do that.
For a very long time. When you look at the amount of radio stations that are still around and have been around for a long time,
no, 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 you're not helping me, John. Uri, no. Don't do that. Okay, Uri, go.
Let me try and help you. So there are some people that no matter what you'll do are never going to give it. So they're going to listen to the station and will never give money. Those are not the people that you should go after. The people you should go after are people that say, yeah, sure, I'll get to the office and I'll give them some money. And then they get to the office, but, you know, they're busy over there, so they don't. They need to find not the free riders, not the people that will say, look, I don't want to pay for it, someone else should. You should try and concentrate on the people that say, yeah, I should give, but then never give. Those are that's your target audience, not the chronicle free riders.
All right, so we got to figure out a way to get people to do the irrational thing, which is to give to their public radio station because they love public radio, and that they get the altruistic feeling when they provide public radio, when they get the good programmings on the air. And I would definitely want to thank you guys for explaining that to us. Uri Ghanizi and John A. List, authors of the Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Thanks for joining us on The Source.
Thank you.